Our opening words to call us to worship this morning come from Erica Hewitt, and she's also the author of the words I'll use for lighting the Advent candles. First comes the waiting. This is the season of endings and beginnings, when the small signs of dawn pierce through the night and something new is born. But first comes the waiting. First comes the lesson of endings and beginnings. The presence of life, the sheltering spirit of love, grieves with those sweeping up the debris of loss, waits with those who restlessly reach out for change, grants us courage in the night to guard each other's dreams for this holy, wondrous universe. Grant us, O universe, unfolding in mystery, a sense of your timing. May we loosen our grip on that which doesn't serve us, leaving behind that which we have outworn and outgrown. Teach us the lessons of beginnings. Remind us that such waitings and endings may be a starting place, a planting of seeds which bring to birth that which is ready to be born, something right and just and different, a new song, a deeper relationship, a fuller love in the fullness of time. I'm going to invite Mike Fitzer to light our chalice this morning. And these words for lighting the Advent wreath come also, as I said, from Erica Hewitt. Peace. The four candles on this wreath count down through the season of winter's dark leading into the light. Advent is a time of waiting, of cultivating patience. The season asks us to hold faith that all that we are becoming is awakening under the surface of our lives. On this second Sunday of Advent, we light the candle of peace with these words of Pema Chodron, a Buddhist nun. If we want there to be peace in the world, we have to be brave enough to soften what is rigid in our hearts, to find the soft spot and stay with it. We have to have that kind of courage and take that kind of responsibility. That's the true practice of peace. May this time of waiting inspire our courage. May we find the soft spot in the pressures of the season and stay with it as we discern our way forward. May we be filled with loving kindness. May we be at ease and discover the true practice of peace within us so that there might be peace in the world. Our message for all ages today, I'm delighted to present our youth coordinator, Paul. Paul was in a play of the musical version of Little Women earlier this fall in November, and he played Professor Bear. He's going to introduce the character and tell his relationship to the March family, and he's going to be doing this as Professor Bear, so he's going to be in character for this piece of the service, and I'm delighted to have him in front of you this morning. I was going to get him to sing because he has such a fabulous voice, but none of the songs really fit. So we're just going to keep working on that for some future Sunday. Meanwhile, Professor.
Hello, my name is Professor Bear, but as we are friends, you may call me Fritz. And today it is my privilege to tell you about the most amazing woman I know, Josephine March, though she always preferred to go by Jo. Our story begins not very far from here at all, in Concord, Massachusetts. Jo March is one of four sisters, not the eldest, alas, no. Meg is oldest, then Jo, her sister Beth, and Amy the youngest. This Christmas time, they are all of them feeling a little gloomy, less happy and festive than the season would warrant, for their father is away, serving as a chaplain in the war, and they have very little coin. Time has become hard for them. Nonetheless, they are sisters. They live, they fight, they play, and they are family. They love one another. Trying to cheer each other up, imagining what presents they might spend their small money on for each other, they instead choose to spend them getting presents for their mother. And in this excitement, they draw the attention of their neighbor, Mr. Lawrence, who lives across the street, a grumpy old man who initially does not take to them very well, but as time passes, comes to really be a friend to their family. Not only does Mr. Lawrence live across the street, but his grandson, Theodore Lawrence III, or Laurie, also lives there. And he will figure quite prominently in this tale, for he is the brother to this family that they do not have of their own, but becomes somewhat of an adoptive sibling. They have all sorts of shenanigans that they run into as a collective group of five, these four sisters and Laurie, led by Joe. Joe is not what you would consider as your regular girl, young woman. She is very independent, strong-willed, and does not like the ladylike things like her older sister Meg. Rather, she prefers to dress in men's clothes and participate in sporting activities far beyond the childish age where such things are acceptable. She dreams of being a writer, a published, famous writer, and writes fantastic wild tales. Eventually, she pursues this dream of hers. She travels to New York to try to make it as a writer. And this is where I first met Joe March, in a small, drab boarding house on a very busy, loud, crowded street. For as a professor of the language arts, one's income does not facilitate finer accommodations. But it was here that I got to hear her writing, and I must say, it was not that good. She wrote as the style of the day demanded, these sensationalist tales that, well, frankly, I think she could do better. And I told her so, and that went over not as well as I might have hoped. But eventually, she did take my advice. She wrote from her heart. And just as she had found a publisher who was willing to write and produce her stories, she was called home again with the sickness of her sister Beth, who had contracted scarlet fever. She traveled home and did not make it back to New York. She cared for her sister until she passed. And so it was left upon me to come find her. She had wrote in our communications that if I were ever to travel north, I should come visit her. And I will be honest, I could not get her out of my mind even after she had left the city. Her independence, her resilience, her strength. And so I made my way up here to your cold, cold part of the world. And here it was that I came to stay and live with Joe and her family for a time. We opened a school, a boarding house, and it has been some of the most incredible experiences I have ever had. I hope at some point perhaps you may take some time yourself to travel to Concord. It is not so far a ride for you as it was for me. And visit the Orchard House, where much of this story is detailed in greater length. Thank you.
Our words for prayer or meditation this morning come from Lucinda S. Duncan. God of life and beauty, we pray for the quietness of snowflakes, knowing that love is quiet. We pray for the kindness of small acts, knowing gentleness is fragile. We are grateful to know that thoughtfulness makes no sound, that compassion leaves wonderfully beautiful traces when we open ourselves to wonder. May ours be a religion which, like the snowflake, goes everywhere in quietness, in love, and with gentle regard for that which is true and beautiful in us and about us. Blessed be, and amen. The book Little Women by Louisa May Alcott begins like this. "Christmas won't be Christmas without any presents," grumbled Joe, lying on the rug. "It's so dreadful to be poor," sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress. "I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things and other girls nothing at all," added little Amy with an injured sniff. "We've got father and mother and each other," said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again as Joe said sadly, "We haven't got father and shall not have him for a long time." She didn't say, "Perhaps never," but each silently added it, thinking of father far away where the fighting was. Nobody spoke for a moment, and then Meg said in an altered tone, "You know, the reason Mother proposed not having any presents this Christmas was because it's going to be a hard winter for everyone, and she thinks we ought not to spend money for pleasure when our men are suffering in the army. We can't do much, but we can make our little sacrifices and ought to do it gladly. But I'm afraid I don't." And Meg shook her head as she thought regretfully of all the pretty things she wanted. "But I don't think the little we should spend would do any good. We've got each got a dollar, and the army wouldn't be much helped by our giving that. I agree not to expect anything from Mother or you, but I do want to buy Undine and Cintron for myself. I've wanted it for so long," said Joe, who was a bookworm. "I plan to spend mine in new music," said Beth with a little sigh, which no one heard but the hearth brush and the kettle holder. "I shall get a nice box of Faber's drawing pencils. I really need them," said Amy decidedly. "Mother didn't say anything about our money, and she wouldn't wish us to give up everything. Let's each buy what we want and have a little fun. I'm sure we work hard enough to earn it," said Joe, examining the heels of her shoes in a gentlemanly manner. "I know I do, teaching those tiresome children nearly all day, when I'm beginning to enjoy myself at home," began Meg in the complaining tone again. And so it goes on. The girls complain about their hardships, but then turn their thoughts to maybe they should each buy something for their mother, and they make plans to do that. And then they begin squabbling a little bit. And Amy says, "So did I, Beth. Well, I think we were, for though we do have to work, we make fun of ourselves and are a pretty jolly set, as Joe would say." "Joe does use such slang words." "Oh, I guess that was Meg," observed Amy with a reproving look at the long figure stretched out on the rug. Joe immediately sat up and put her hands in her pockets and began to whistle. "Don't, Joe. It's so boyish. That's why I do it. I detest rude, unladylike girls." That's Amy. "I hate affected nimmy-pimmy chits." That's Joe. "Birds in their little nests agree," sang Beth, the peacemaker, with such a funny face that both sharp voices softened to a laugh, and the pecking ended for a time. "Really, girls, you are both to be blamed," said Meg, beginning to lecture in her elderly, sisterly fashion. "You are old enough to leave off boyish tricks and to behave better, Josephine. It didn't matter so much when you were a little girl, but now you are so tall and turn up your hair, and you should remember that you are a young lady." "I'm not. And if turning up my hair makes me one, I'll wear it in two tails till I'm 20, cried Jo, pulling off her net and shaking down a chestnut mane. "I hate to think I've got to grow up and be Miss March and wear long gowns and look as prim as a China aster. It's bad enough to be a girl anyway when I like boys' games and work and manners. I can't get over my disappointment in not being a boy. And it's worse than ever now, for I'm dying to go and fight with Papa, and I can only stay home and knit like a pokey old woman." And Joe shook the blue army sock till the needles rattled like castanets, and her ball bounced it across the room. "Poor Joe, it's too bad, but it can't be helped. So you must try to be contented with making your name boyish and playing brother to us girls," said Beth, stroking the rough head with a hand that all the dishwashing and the dusting in the world could not make ungentle in its touch. And thus begins the story of Little Women. This year, we share our weekly offering with FPC's guest table this month in December. And this is a pretty appropriate thing for this story that we're talking about of Little Women today, because it was not uncommon in that story for them to put on meals for other people who needed them. And here's a little quote from Little Women as we pass our plates today. Money is a needful and precious thing, and well used, a noble thing. But I never want you to think it is the first or only prize to strive for. So, why am I taking a look at a children's book, a girl's book, written over 100 years ago, full of stuffy language and syrupy sentiments? Well, I'm going to answer that question eventually, but first, a little personal story. When I was growing up, books were a precious treasure, and the ones you liked best you were likely to read over and over again and again. My parents owned, they had subscribed to some sort of Book of the Month Club or something, and they had a top shelf filled with hardbound classics in our living room. And up there was a full set of Louisa May Alcott's books. And so one of the books I read over and over again was Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. I mean, I read Little Men and Eight Cousins and all the rest as well, but mostly just Little Women over and over again. I didn't know then as a child the transcendentalism or the Unitarianism of Louisa May Alcott, and I had never been to Orchard House in Concord. What I knew was that this heroine, with her love of writing, her fierce independence, her belief that she could be whatever she wanted to be, and that she was meant for more than home and hearth, here was a feminist icon that I could look to. I remember my family going to see the 1994 movie adaptation. I was away at graduate school that year, but I'd come home for the holidays to my parents' home north of Atlanta. And I'm pretty sure it was on Christmas afternoon that we all decided we'd go out to the theater and see Little Women. Coming out of the theater, I turned to my sister Carrie and I said, "I bet you," I named some dollar amount, "bet you $10 any minute now, Mom is going to tearfully call us her Little Women." My sister wisely did not take that bet. And the moment came before we had made it to the car. Now, perhaps every girl of a certain age who was a bit bookish read Little Women and considered herself to be a modern-day Joan March. I certainly did, as one of three or four sisters. Clearly, my middle sister, Kathy, who was the first to be married and worked in a preschool, she must be Meg. And my little sister, Carrie, who had been kind of a brat when she was young and was always gallivanting off to Europe those days, she must be Amy. And my sister, who died in stillbirth, I made her Beth. Now, Kathy disagrees with this theory, of course, and thinks that she's Joe, and Carrie probably disagrees also, but this is immaterial because it was clear I was the Joe of the family. Now, since that time, I've actually become much more of a Louisa May Alcott fan, learning about the history of her life, her ties to the sages of Concord, Emerson and Thoreau and Fuller, her history in the war. All of this made me much more interested, especially as I delved into Unitarian Universalism for my life's work. When I learned that Little Women was being made into a new movie coming out this Christmas, 25 years, I think, after the last Christmas Day when I saw it, and that it was being directed by Greta Gerwig, and Greta herself is a Unitarian Universalist, and oh, it was also being largely filmed around here, well, I decided what better thing to do than to preach on Little Women in this holiday season. So why am I taking a look at a children's book, a girl's book, written over 100 years ago, full of stuffy language and syrupy sentiments? I'll get there. But first, a little bit about Louisa May Alcott herself, and then I'll share some of the things that the book taught me. Louisa May Alcott was the child of two Unitarians. Her mother, Abigail May, was the sister of Unitarian minister Samuel Joseph May. And Samuel Joseph May was a noted abolitionist, famed eventually for successfully aiding a fugitive slave named John McHenry. A statue to May and McHenry stands in the middle of Syracuse, New York, where the local Unitarian church is named May Memorial Unitarian Church. Samuel May is the one who introduced his sister Abigail to Bronson Alcott. Now, Bronson Alcott was a transcendentalist Unitarian and a school teacher. He had some unusual educational philosophies, and his first locations, maybe pretty much all his locations until he set up a school of his own in Concord, he was not well received, and he was often fired a few times, many times. He set up his own commune at one point, Fruitlands, where they tried to implement his philosophies and live a vegetarian lifestyle, and again, it failed. So apparently one of the reasons that his philosophies were not so well appreciated was that he encouraged students to question whether or not the Bible miracles were literal. And another thing he did was bring in the African-American students in to sit with white students, both of these not very well received at the time. Louisa May Alcott's parents were strong abolitionists like her uncle, and they had discussions with Frederick Douglass, and when she was 15, her family hosted a fugitive slave for a period. They were part of the Underground Railroad. They were also well connected with the transcendentalists in the area, of which Bronson Alcott was one. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau, and Margaret Fuller were all part of their social circle when they moved to Concord. Louisa May Alcott actually had a bit of a crush on Emerson for a while. And her father lent his axe to Thoreau when he built his home at Walden Pond. But it was Louisa May who would pull the family out of poverty. As an abolitionist, she involved herself in the Civil War, serving as a nurse until she got typhoid and was too sick to continue. But before, during, and after that time period, her feminist spirit compelled her to write, first under a pseudonym and then ultimately as herself. So why are we studying this book, this children's book, this girl's book full of syrupy sentiments? What are the lessons I've learned from Little Women? What makes this worth our study? The first lesson that I came to is about the ending everyone else wanted versus the ending Louisa wanted. Today, authors of books and movies and television have to contend a lot with what we call shipping. That is, people who want certain characters to ship or to have a relationship. Louisa May Alcott was one of the first authors to have to deal with this in a serious way. Little did she know what would fall to later authors like J.K. Rowling and whoever writes the various trilogies and trilogies upon trilogies upon trilogies that we have in the movies these days. She wrote Little Women in two parts and published the first part first before she had written the second part. And by the end of reading it, fans from all over were writing her and largely demanding that Joe and Lori must fall in love and get married. Her editor demanded this too. Her mother actually forwarded her fan mail, where she had fled to Europe, basically to avoid it, I think. And Louisa wrote back to her mother, "Don't send me any more letters from so cracked girls. The rampant infants must wait." The fans wanted their fairy tale ending. And that would have made this story a very traditional story. And really something not radical from a lot of other stories that came before or that followed. Not very different from your average fairy tale. However, fed up with her fans and determined to have her heroine one who broke the mold that people tried to force her into, Louisa had Lori propose early on in Volume 2, and Joe turned down that proposal flat and then go off to New York and become a writer. It's not till much later in the novel that she finally finds herself in love with the much less dashing Professor Bear. It wasn't the ending that everyone wanted. It wasn't even really the ending that Louisa May Alcott wanted, because she would have left Joe single. But ultimately, it was a novel, pun intended, ending for Joe March. Professor Bear symbolized what she wanted for her character, what Joe wanted for herself, perhaps. But most importantly, he symbolized what she didn't want. Joe didn't want her story to be written for her. She wanted to find her independence and to be a writer. And Professor Bear meets her when she's doing all that and validates the woman that she is. Validates the fact that she's branching out on her own, she's living in New York, she's supporting herself. He supports her being this woman and doesn't keep her being the girl next door that Lori fell in love with. So that's the first lesson. Don't let everyone else tell you how your story ends. You make your own decisions. The second lesson of Little Women has to do with Joe's writing. Joe begins the story with writing wild and extravagant, sweeping epics full of adventures and evildoers. You picture people with like swirly mustaches saying, ha ha ha. But as the story goes on, she matures. And she learns to write from what she knows. She turns to stories and poems about the people in her own life. Her dreams of fame and fortune turn out to be not what she's really interested in after all. And the life and career she builds are good and true, and they make her happy and content. She doesn't live anything like the life she imagined she would, and she doesn't write the kinds of books she imagined she would, but her life is real, and it is authentic, and it is honest in a way that the illusion was not. Similarly, her sister Amy wanted to travel to Europe and to be the best artist in the world and live a life of fame and luxury. What both women find is that their childhood dreams were illusions and that real life actually awaits. The book is about adjusting expectations, but that once you set aside what is illusory, you can discover what is real. I think this part resonated with me particularly because as a young girl, I dreamed of being an author of big, sweeping children's novels or science fiction and fantasy. And when I started to actually write, and I was an English major, the writing that I was trying to do turned out to be something different. It turned out to be sermons. That wasn't what I intended to start out writing, and that wasn't what was right for the academy, and it's certainly not what would be right for a published story, but it was right for what I ultimately did. And that was real, and it was true. The third lesson in Little Women is the feminist message. And in this, the character of Jo parallels Louisa May Alcott's own life. Louisa May Alcott was a feminist, which is no surprise, since she was exposed to such figures as Elizabeth Palmer Peabody and Margaret Fuller. As an article in The Atlantic put it, the novel is about navigating adolescence to become graceful little women, but the story itself pushes back against that frame. The character who continually resists conforming to traditional expectations of demure femininity and domesticity, Jo, is the true heroine. And the character who unfailingly acquiesces, Beth, dies shortly after reaching adulthood. It's no wonder that many women have found this book inspirational. A book review of Anne Boyd Rue's book, Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, in the New Republic says this. Every major modern woman writer has had some kind of relationship to the novel. Ursula K. Le Guin found Jo March in their original image of a woman writer. Erica Jong has said the book told me that women could be writers, intellects. Elizabeth Alexander declares it formative. Bell Hooks said she found remnants of myself in Jo. And the feminism that Louisa May Alcott gives us is not surprisingly the dated essentialist feminism we might think it would be. It actually has new things to tell us in every era. It had new things to say when it was written. It had new things to say in second wave feminism in the 70s and 80s. It has new things to tell us now. Throughout the beginning of the book, Jo tells us she wants to be like a man, to be able to do what men do. As I read in the first chapter, Jo says, it's bad enough to be a girl anyway when I like boys' games and work and manners. I can't get over my disappointment in not being a boy. And then she says, it's worse than ever now. I'm dying to go and fight with Papa, and I can only stay home and knit like a pokey old woman. Of course, Louisa May Alcott didn't go and fight, but she did go and serve in the Civil War, unlike the transcendentalist men around her, actually. And this sentiment that Jo utters about being like a boy or being a boy is one Louisa shared in her life as well. In her book, Anne Boyd Rue asks, what does it mean that this venerated story of girlhood centers on a girl who doesn't want to be one at all? Ultimately, Louisa gives us in Jo a heroine who shows us that girls can like boys' games and do boys' works and have the manner and style that are masculine and still be a girl, or maybe not. In other words, in a very 19th century way, Louisa May Alcott is showing us that gender is a spectrum. Today's Jo might be using they, them pronouns and considering themselves non-binary. Or today's Jo might be using he, him pronouns and considering himself a boy. At the time it was written, such a heroine was radical, and it was transformative. It still is today. Now, I would like to say that one reason to read Little Women is because it taught me transcendentalism and Unitarian history. Alas, this is not so much the case. Louisa May Alcott actually wrote a satire of transcendentalism called Transcendental Wild Oats, like parodying the Fruitlands utopia that her father had tried to create. And given what she and her family suffered at her father's lack of employment due to his transcendentalist philosophy, she perhaps had the right to be cynical about that belief. You might say that in Little Women, the fact that the father is almost an absentee figure for much of the book, while Marmee, the mother, is much more central, shows a little disdain for her father's philosophies. But while the book doesn't teach transcendentalism, And this is my last thing to share today of what I learned from Little Women. It does teach dreams and values of our faith today that are still at the core of our philosophy, just as they were then. Truthfully, her beliefs and values permeate Little Women. Jo March and her family express a lot of religious sentiment. They read Pilgrim's Progress. Their father becomes a clergyman. But the religious expression in the novel isn't just found in church. It permeates everything. The progressive anti-slavery and feminist values that are shown in there, the belief in the inherent goodness of people that comes up over and over and over again. And throughout Little Women, we see the March girls make mistakes. They hurt each other. They do stupid things. But they always come back to their inherent goodness and their love for each other. And that's the most important value held up in the book, the love of family. There are values of honesty, of love, of family, and many more, of charity that are held throughout the book, and the sense that these values and goodness are inherent, that they are trustworthy, that they are true, that they are guiding principles. And here's where Emerson and Thoreau differ from Louisa May Alcott. Whereas Emerson writes self-reliance and Thoreau goes to the woods, Louisa's narrative centers on family and its importance. And throughout reading about that family in Little Women, I was learning what life was like for those Unitarian figures in Concord and the people that surrounded them. But family, the enduring importance of people who you love surrounding you, that's the bottom line message of Little Women and what still resonates today as it has in every age. So why am I taking a look at a children's book, a girl's book today? Well, first of all, and last of all, what better thing to do? Because children are important. And the messages we give to young girls and young boys and young non-binary children, those are important too. It's no surprise that at the end of her life, Louisa May Alcott was the country's most popular author. She had written a book for children and specifically for girls at a time when girls were first being educated to read. Nobody had done this before because nobody could do this before, write a book for girls. And that made it fantastic. But it wasn't just fantastic because it was any book for girls. It was this book for girls and for non-binary children and for boys as well. That's why decade after decade, filmmakers continue to explore her work. And that's why it continues to have so much to say to us.